This call is being recorded. If you do not wish to be recorded, please disconnect at this time.
Good morning, and thank you for being part of the webinar. I am here today with Alan Snyder, whom we've known for several years, and I'm very enthusiastic about this webinar because Alan has made a whole business and made it his focus to solve the problem that I think is the investment problem of our time, which is how to generate income without taking too much risk of principal loss in a zero interest rate world. And before we jump in, I want to give everyone my cell phone number so that you can text me any questions. I love getting questions during the webinar because it helps me make sure that the content we're covering is exactly what's most valuable and interesting to you. So my number is 310-428-9109, 310-428-9109, and please help me out by sending me a text, letting me know what's interesting to you as we go. So Alan, why don't we start out briefly with your background, because you have a very deep experience as an investment manager and portfolio manager, and then briefly give us a quick overview of what your fund is all about.
Sure. First of all, let me say thank you for Jan and Dana for organizing this and doing all of the setup, which is quite a hassle, and thank you for the listeners on the phone. My checkered past, I'm embarrassed to say, goes back a long time. I was a Wall Street guy for years at a predecessor firm, ultimately became Morgan Stanley, where I ran most of the product areas. Topically for this conversation, my swan song there was working with a couple of other people and getting the Discover Card started. We'll come back to that in a bit. From there, clearly, I'm a vagabond. I ambled off because that became no fun. Worked for a while with Goldman Sachs and Kelso as a special advisor. Then had the temerity to move out to California, where I spent 7 years restructuring California's largest insurance company. Now, this company, again, topically for this conversation, had cornered the market. It was a $20 billion portfolio in high-yield bonds. And the argument on high-yield bonds has always been, gee, the rates are high enough, so even if defaults go up, it's okay. By and large, it's been true. However, today, they've got compression versus treasuries or other corporates, and you've got longer duration, and I think there's a better solution, which I'll go into in a little bit. All during this time period, I had Shinnecock, because when I quit Wall Street, I woke up one morning, some of you may have experienced this, and said, oh my God, I have a few pennies. What am I going to do with them? Because I know Wall Street never met a fee they didn't like, and casual about risk. So I said, geez, I don't want to lose it. So that was the genesis of starting Shinnecock, which at various times has been operating in the background, but for the last good period of time, I've been at Shinnecock full time after selling the last company I started.
So you are full time devoted to managing a fund called a Shinnecock branded fund. So what does that fund seek to do?
Okay. It's near and dear to my black heart. The fund we call the Shinnecock Income Fund. And interestingly, maybe at least for us, people said to me, Snyder, you've built endless financial products in your checkered past. Can't you build an investment that will protect me if interest rates rise, and if there's another 2008, I'm not going to get killed? It seemed like an impossible mission, and I sort of went around and with one foot nailed to the floor in circles, and ultimately, we've made in Shinnecock about 5 years ago our first investment in an alternative lender. I woke up and said, alternative lending could provide that answer. And
I have a question. Did you set out with that strategy because of a request from one or more investor or clients, or did you yourself want this before, and did you decide on that strategy independent of what your clients said they were looking for?
Well, we looked at it. I guess the browbeating I was taking from interested parties, since only in the last 3 or 4 years have we accepted outside money, that influenced me. And I'm the largest investor as an individual in Shinnecock, so I was pretty motivated. And the y'all have received the a few slides, and let me just tick through them. We said, could you generate a compelling yield? And the answer is yes. Net to an investor, you can earn, again, whether it's us or the space, somewhere between 7 and 8% net yield, very attractive. When you've got treasuries, at least this morning trading 10-year treasuries at about 204, that gets to the next item, protection against the unexpected. What if rates really go up? Well, gosh and gollies, they've gone up. Hold on to your knickers. 50% since July. Rates were about 137 on the 10-year. Now they're 204 when I walked over here.
Wow.
So it's a risk you want to be sensitive to, because longer duration, you're going to get crushed.
If you owned a 10-year treasury and bought it in July, and it had a 10 years left on its term, and now how much would the value have dropped?
Substantially, you can figure 1% for every 10% in a 30-year for every 1% increase. A 10-year probably about half of that.
So has the value dropped up to 10% of the value of that bond be gone? Maybe not quite that much.
Maybe not
like
that much.
5%.
But meaningful.
5%.
Meaningful.
3%, 4%, something like that.
At least that.
So compared to the interest rate you're getting, you lost 2 years' worth of principal, interest on the principal loss.
Right. Ugly.
Ugly. Okay.
Here's
the question, though. So why is so much money trapped? And we're going to move quickly.
Good. Let's go.
Why is so much money trapped in these types of strategies that have so much risk? For example, BlackRock has been doing an advertising campaign in the Wall Street Journal for a couple of years, basically saying, watch out, your bond portfolio has more risk than you think. And they've done a great job educating people about those risks. And yet, everybody still owns a ton of bonds. And, you know, the alternative managers like yourselves or us or others, you know, we're like a tiny, tiny, not even a grain of sand on the beach of the fixed income world. So why are so many people still attached to this sort of traditional fixed income world when it's so risky? Why do you think that it's why do you think people haven't gravitated to this more?
Because it takes work. And while the alternative lending space, and by the way, I should define it, alternative lenders are those where you as the investor are going to earn the spread as opposed to a bank. It's a conduit between an investor and the ultimate borrower in all different flavors of ice cream. Mm-hmm. Why? I think because it takes work. It's off the beaten path. Most broker-dealers, which are advertising, don't play in it. While the whole market, the alternative lending market, is a $51 trillion market globally. Now, there are different executions, but I think it's relatively undiscovered except for sophisticated investors, et cetera. And it takes a lot of due diligence.
So it's basically people are scared to go away from what's familiar to them, and it just takes more work, and they're not willing to do the work or don't know how to do the work. Is that the issue?
I think that's it.
But you figured out how. So let's talk about your fund. You're an alternative lending fund, and give us an idea of what are the biggest components of your pie chart in your fund? What's the number one piece of the pie by size? What type of loans are they?
Well,
what type of borrowers?
First you got to always, as you listen to any portfolio manager chatter about what they're doing, to calibrate the remarks. Let me go on record, I'm a chicken and the thought of losing money is terrible. So our prejudice has been we want super diversification. We want diversification across different asset classes of loans. In our case, it's secured consumer lending with a small dollop, very little of marketplace lending. We'll come back to that for anybody that wants to talk about it, because I think there's some risks that investors are violently underestimating in marketplace lending, which is probably the most popular press-related issue. So secured consumer lending, small business lending in different flavors, think hard asset lending, lending against hard assets with very high coupons, to lending to businesses, maybe high growth businesses, where the lender is getting a yield plus an equity derivative, maybe warrants, options, or a conversion feature, to something near and dear to your heart, bridge financing and real estate. In our case, given our desire to have 2-year duration in the portfolio, short duration real estate lending.
So the top four would be?
Well, there's a couple more. Let me just nail the whole thing.
Okay.
Trade finance, moving a cargo of grain, let's say, from Africa to China.
So is it secured by the product?
Secured by the product.
Okay.
And lastly, it would include a chunk of life settlements.
Now, is that a type of lending too?
I think it's a type of lending,
okay.
Yes. Now, the whole portfolio, given our wimpy nature, 89% of it is secured lending.
Mm-hmm. 11% is unsecured.
11%.
Is the unsecured part consumer lending or business lending?
It's consumer lending.
Consumer. So that would be like a credit card.
It'd be very similar to credit card debt.
Okay. Yes. So you've got something like 6 different strategies within this fund.
Right.
With different types of loans. And is it relatively spread evenly among them, or is it more dominant to one or the other? You mentioned consumer lending first.
Which is the smallest. I would say the heaviest allocation is small business lending, probably because you have the most diversity, the most different types of executions. And one thing that's noteworthy, and you all might shoot me, there's no student loan debt. Now, SoFi, for those of you probably on the call know them, they're very good. The yields are not so great, and they underestimated prepayments, which lowered the yield. The non-SoFi student lending, I think, is very risky because it's like you're fighting the tape or fighting City Hall, because the federal government has said, oh, you know, to the students, I'm not arguing social policy, said, hey, we think it's a bad deal, and maybe you don't have to pay it back, so the default rate is huge.
Okay, so quick question. The election that happened yesterday, is there anything in that election that you think adjusts or impacts the opportunity for non-bank lending?
Yes. I think two things, and this was really true for both candidates. You're seeing a sea change between monetary stimulus and fiscal stimulus. Hillary talked about it, as did the Donald. Now, the Donald, I think, will be more aggressive than Hillary was, which probably explains why you've had maybe even a greater pickup in yield today.
More aggressive with fiscal stimulus?
Fiscal stimulus.
Like more. Infrastructure spending?
Well, Hillary said $250 billion. Donald said maybe up to $1 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talked about other things that would be highly stimulative to the economy. Ergo, boy, it makes me feel comfortable about having that 2-year duration.
So part of the value proposition for your fund and your strategy, as well as ours, is that banks have been sort of hamstrung and are not able to make loans, even loans they should be making that are good loans, they oftentimes can't do for regulatory reasons. Is there any chance that if this new group of elected officials and administration, that the banks are freed up in a very substantial way, or is that highly unlikely in your view?
A couple of reasons why it's hard for a bank. One, and again, if anybody wants some of the research we've done, I'm happy to send it to you. I mean, Harvard Business School did an in-depth analysis, for example, on small business lending. They think small business lending is basically leaving the banks for several reasons. One, you have Dodd-Frank. Two, you have Basel III. Three, you have a cost structure that is, on top of those costs, very expensive and hard to execute. So the banks say, to hell with it. We'll loan bigger loans, and okay, the little loans, which are expensive to service, will not play. Now, will the banks get back into it? I don't think so. The banks are partnering with a lot of these companies.
Okay, so we have 4 minutes left of the regular interview, and then we're going to go to Q&A. And I'd like to request a question from somebody out there. Please do text me at 310-428-9109 so that we can know that you're out there and see what you're most interested in. But a couple of rapid-fire questions with our last remaining minutes before the Q&A. What is the hardest part of what you do? The hardest part, if you're trying to build a portfolio of income-generating non-bank lending strategies, what's the hardest part of what you do?
Well, I think Ben Franklin said it best. He said, diligence is the mother of good luck. And we embrace the concept of doing due diligence. So what are we? We're in some ways a giant talent hunt for the best and the brightest people that can execute this. There's no way we can select loans in each one of these categories. We've made the decision we want a domain expert, and finding them is bloody hard. So, and then you've got to diligence them till the cows come home. Let me, one quick example. Before we invest, and we've done this for 27 years at Shinnecock, we will engage a bunch of ex-FBI guys, a company, to do deep research on the principles of any of the money managers we select. And I know this won't shock anybody. Occasionally, they haven't volunteered everything, and we find something that says we don't invest with them, as an example. Mm-hmm. So I think it's
diligence. So the diligence is the hard part. What is the thing you like most about the strategy, which you have put your own money into here? What do you like most about it? What's the single best feature from your perspective?
Again, it's the belt and suspenders guy you're talking with. The best thing to me, going back to that high yield bond example, here, this is like that but on steroids, because you have this incredible buffer of a very high yield. And at least the portfolio that we have identified has about a 2.5% default rate. So you've got yield so high you can have a 450% buffer.
Fantastic. I'm going to go to some questions that are relevant, and then I have another couple of questions for you. So one question was, what's the relationship between Arixa and Shinnecock was one of the questions I had, and I think I had that question. And there's no relationship. Basically, there's no business relationship. Shinnecock is not an investor in our funds.
Well,
one
thing I got to say, I think as we look at money managers all over the place, I respect what Arixa has accomplished. So that's the relationship.
And likewise, we respect your approach to this problem, which we've thought about a lot, and you're taking an interesting approach. And I had a question. What's the minimum investment in your fund? This is not supposed to be about marketing any fund,
right?
Although we talk about funds, but it's supposed to be about strategies. But why don't you go ahead and say what's the minimum investment in your fund, just so people know. It's only open to accredited investors,
good.
Correct?
Yes.
Okay.
I assume everybody on the call is accredited as well. So
we've advertised it for accredited investors.
It's $250,000.
Okay. And do you ever accept lesser amounts? Do you have the discretion to accept lesser amounts, or have you made a practice of just saying, we'll keep to that?
Generally, we don't.
You don't. Okay. Another question I have is, how much money in all the Shinnecock funds, what is Arixa selling here? Well, I'm going to answer that part. Arixa is sponsoring this event series because we like to be part of the community of people who are thinking about this problem of how do you generate income today with a margin of safety. And we think that some people who discover us through this webinar series will probably come to us and ask us about our funds at some point, or go to our website And it's a very indirect thing. We try to make this truly educational. It's sort of like, my past employer way back when, Goldman Sachs, does all kinds of research. They're having a call today about the impact of the election on investments. And they do that, of course they do that to generate business, but they do that because they think that the goodwill of providing good content will ultimately lead to business. And I think of it the same way. So that's the answer to that question.
And by the way, I just jump in. I totally agree with that because you can find endless educational stuff on what we've been talking about on our website, which is shinnecock.com. In fact, I got an email yesterday from somebody saying, Alan, are you nuts? You just published and put on your website the 363 due diligence questions that you ask money managers. Are you giving away your crown jewels? And I said, no, because it's all in how you execute it.
And I will attest, I looked through those questions, and if I had to write written responses, I think it would take me, I'm a fast writer, and it would probably take me 6 months to finish that due diligence questionnaire. So it's very thorough. Are you willing to talk about the amount of money in all the Shinnecock funds in any way, or do you want, it's up to you, but that's a question we have. You can maybe bracket it.
I'll just bracket it. Shinnecock has moderately under $100 million, but substantially more than that, and substantial assets in this alternative lending fund, which is growing, which is a nice thing.
So I want to keep going. Thank you to the people who asked questions, and we would like more questions to my cell phone, 310-428-9109. In the meantime, I will ask a question on my list, which is, we talked about what you think is the biggest benefit for you. What's the biggest risk that you think about for your fund?
Well, just the energy that you've kind of got to employ to constantly evaluate, stay on top, monitor the existing allocations, and look for new ones. One risk for the benefit of the audience I really want to share is in marketplace lending, investors are drawn to the bright, shiny object, the highest rates that somebody prints. I can't stress enough, every investor that's on the call that has an investment in marketplace lending, be sure that you've looked at the valuation policy of wherever you're invested, because the fair value accounting is all over the place in that space, and the one that's printing the highest yield, I think there's going to be changes to that, and you're going to see some ugly surprises.
So I'm going to take that opportunity to let people know that our next webinar on December 14th is about marketplace lending, and it is called New Ways to Participate in Marketplace Lending, and we're going to have Philip Bartow from River North, which has a closed-end interval fund that invests in loans procured through a number of different marketplace lending platforms. And then we have another webinar coming up January 11th with Elizabeth Brayman from Realty Mogul, and she will be talking about their new e-REIT, which is a REIT that invests in real estate and real estate debt. And it's also, they're sort of a marketplace investment company as well. So we're going to have more content on that because it's a hot topic. I share some of your concerns about marketplace lending, and I appreciate them. So the biggest risk you said is just, I'm going to see if I can paraphrase it. It sounds like one of the biggest risks is that one of the managers that you selected so carefully turns from a good, diligent manager into a sloppy manager, or worse, dishonest manager. Is that what you really were saying there, monitoring that they don't change over time?
I'll give you one fun war story. One of the things we do is normative behavior modeling for a manager. And you know, the traditional thing is, well, you look at peer-to-peer comparisons. Well, how does Jan compare to Harry over here or to Dana? Mm-hmm. That's good, but I also want to know, is Jan performing at the expected level for Jan, or is there strategy drift? So we use a series of regression tools to keep track of Jan. And if Jan is performing more than one standard deviation, either up or down, clearly that should happen, our monitoring goes dramatically higher.
One standard deviation up or down away from what?
Their normative behavior, their regression. We've tried with Bayesian statistics. I can't get the damn thing
to work. This is a topic for a whole other call because, but this is a fascinating question. For example, in our strategy, how would you know what their norm is? Our industry, you know, there were hard money lenders before the financial crisis, for sure, but the world of funds that do private lending that are not hard money but more sort of non-bank lending, service-oriented repeat customers, it's sort of a newer industry. So how do you know what to look for?
Here's what we want to do. We want to look at either the daily returns, weekly, monthly, and compare the returns for that manager against what they've done in the past. Now, it may change, fine, but it bears, if it changes up or down, you want to dig deeper and find out what's changed.
Okay, so this may be a topic for a second call another time. But here's something that I think people on this call will want to know. You've evaluated a lot of managers.
Yes.
What to you are one or two things that you've seen that make you want to run away from a manager, which are maybe not the most obvious warning signs, but they've proven to be warning signs in your experience of something bad happening with that manager?
Two things. I think most people focus and say, oh, my God, what if there's fraud? The two risks associated with fraud. Can somebody cook the books? And two, can somebody run off with your money to Buenos Aires? That's one type. I think there's an overweighting in that. Yes, we grind that into little pebbles. But the biggest risk is performance changes over time. And if the performance goes in the tank.
So for every one Bernie Madoff, there's 10 people who were executing and then their strategy drifts and their fund gets into big trouble with bad investments.
Yes.
Not because of dishonesty, but because of mistakes.
Right. Now, if you guys on the call and ladies want to dig deeper, on our website there's something I think called Mirror, Mirror on the Wall, Who's the Fairest of Them All? And, you know, we have a longer period of time, or at least in writing, to talk about some of these issues.
Okay, on that note, we are approaching 30 minutes, which is the end of our call, so let's open it up to questions. Dana, if you could mute.
All callers are muted. All callers are unmuted.
All right, we'd love to get a volunteer to speak up and ask us a question live right now.
Yeah, this is Larry, and I was wondering, of the four asset classes or areas you invest in, if I have that right, what's the percentage breakdown between, you know, life settlements and the different types of lending you do?
You know, here's the way I would answer it. I would say there's a generic presentation on our website which gives you a breakdown between the different categories. If you want specifics to the fund, I think it's best if we take that offline. As I indicated, there's a heavier allocation in our fund to small business lending, and other than that, it's pretty evenly distributed with a modest allocation to marketplace lending. In fact,
Small business lending is the biggest,
yes.
And then consumer lending, real estate lending, and trade finance, and life settlements would all be sort of
consumer
a little smaller than the first one.
Consumer lending is considerably smaller.
Okay, got it. Onward. Next question.
So, I think that's probably.
Okay, I don't think that doesn't sound like a question. Does anybody else have any questions?
No, I'm assuming we can get a marketing packet by going to the website if we choose to.
You can contact Alan on his website, which is shinnecockpartners.com, correct?
Or either shinnecockpartners.com or shinnecock.com, which is shinnecock. You golf players, of course, recognize the name. And you can send an email to me, which is A, for Alan, A. Snyder, S-N-Y-D-E-R, at Shinnecock.com.
Do you have a contact form on your website so people can contact? You don't have that. Is there an email on your website? So
yes.
Okay. So if you Google Alan Snyder Shinnecock Partners, you will find the website and then send the email to that if you want specific information. Is there any other question from any caller?
Come on, ask one that's killer.
This is Chris Bang. Can you explain the life settlements a bit?
This is Zero. I actually came from Australia.
Sure. Life settlements, having run a large insurance company, I wouldn't have touched the area 10 years ago. It's become institutionalized. The biggest players are Berkshire Hathaway, AIG, Fortress, Leon Black's Apollo. Okay, so it's big market. Basically what it is, if somebody's, let's say, 85 years old and says, you know, my kids have plenty of money, damn it, I'm not going to give them any more money, I'm tired of paying these premiums, what can I do with this policy today, given the regulatory shifts, instead of just surrendering it to the insurance company, where you're not going to get a heck of a lot of money, typically, I can sell that policy to somebody else, and that somebody else is arbitraging how long I'm going to live, i.e. how many more premiums they have to pay before they collect on the death of the insured and get that big death benefit.
Okay, that is a deep topic, which unfortunately we don't have time to go any further. We've gone 2 minutes over. We really appreciate your participating, and I want to remind everybody that we have 2 upcoming webinars, and I hope that you'll all participate in those on December 14th, which is a Wednesday, always at 11 o'clock. We have new ways to participate in marketplace lending, and that's interesting because it's all about marketplace lending, but it's also about a very interesting structure called a closed-end interval fund, where you can invest daily and redeem out quarterly, and it's not marked to market like a public company, but it is marked to value some other way. It's actually very interesting because I think it's an innovative structure that we're going to see more of. And then on January 11th, 2017, Elizabeth Freeman, who heads up all the origination of new investments for Realty Mogul, will be talking about their E-REIT, which is their investment fund, essentially, that they've started. So with that, thank you, and we look forward to hearing from you again.
Thank you.
There is one moderator and 15 participants on the call.